WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new season of HBO's Sex and the City begins Sunday night. Later, we'll hear from its longtime writer and executive producer, Michael Patrick King. First, we hear from the show's star, Sarah Jessica Parker. Yesterday, the series received 10 Emmy nominations, including one for Sarah Jessica Parker's performance as Carrie Bradshaw. She's already won 2 Emmys for her performance on the show. This season will be shortened to 8 episodes because Sarah Jessica Parker is pregnant, but her character is not. Last season dealt with Charlotte's inability to get pregnant, Miranda's unplanned pregnancy, Samantha's falling in love, and Carrie's marriage proposal. While rummaging through her boyfriend's things, Carrie found the engagement ring that he planned to give her. Her response? She threw up. Here she is at the coffee shop, talking with her girlfriends.
What did the ring look like?
Well, that's the other thing. The ring was not good.
What do you mean?
It was a pear-shaped diamond with a gold band.
Oh,
ick!
Ugh, no wonder you threw up.
It's just not me.
You wear gold jewelry?
Yeah, like ghetto gold for fun, but this is my engagement ring.
I helped pick the ring.
You knew about this?
Aiden wanted a female perspective, and P.S. I was a pregnant woman shopping for a ring with a man who wasn't the baby's father. It's not exactly my dream scenario.
At least you're pregnant.
Are you going to yell at me every time I mention it? Because we've got another 7 months to go.
I'll just say, I'm not ready to get engaged yet, but I love you, and I want to live with you. How does that sound?
Like a no.
Carrie accepted the marriage proposal with great ambivalence, but by the end of the season, the relationship broke up and all 4 of the leading characters were single again. In the final episode, Miranda gave birth to a son. I spoke with Sarah Jessica Parker last summer at the Old Wailing Church in Martha's Vineyard at a benefit for public radio station WBUR.
Well, let me start with something that I think people really do want to know. Could you ever imagine living the kind of social life that Carrie Bradshaw does?
No. No, I would be exhausted, and I'm far too old. I am a New Yorker at this point in my life. I've lived in New York City for about 25 years, so I know of these people. I know they exist. I've read about them in the style section. I've seen them on Lower Broadway hailing cabs at unseemly hours of the night in tiny skirts. And my single life was not nearly as colorful as that, which is perhaps why, as a married person, I enjoy playing this part so much. You see, I have to, and it's sort of like legalized illegal behavior. But I think at this point in the show, 4 years into the run of the show, it's become, I think, more specific. I think it's about 4 very specific women in a very specific city at a very specific time, and there's a sort of heightened reality to it, which may not really be consistent with single women anywhere, but I think it is the emotional journey that people seem to have responded to.
2 of the lead writers on the show are gay men, and some people have speculated that some of what happens on the show, particularly what happens to Samantha, who's the person who's really deep into sex, has more to do with like the gay male experience than the experience most women have. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Well, I guess I disagree with that, because we have more female writers than male, and we always have. And I think that they're obviously, people's sensibilities on this show are primarily driven by the emotional search. And if the show were only that sensibility of an idea, a cliched idea about homosexual lifestyles, then they wouldn't be able to write Carrie with soul. And I think the beauty of a writer like Michael Patrick King and Darren Star, who's no longer with us, is that there obviously is a point of view and a perspective that they have because of their chosen lifestyle, but that is not what drives the show. And I think it's fun to sort of project onto Samantha in a general way that she's sort of this a gay man. But I think there are things about her that aren't specifically about gender or lifestyle, but that it's listen, the other three women on the show are absolute archetypes, and they are intentionally so. We have Charlotte, who is hopeful and romantic, and Miranda, and these are bad, you know, two word choices, but who is perhaps cynical and not trusting of love and what it might bring. And then there's Samantha, who is so comfortable with her sexuality, but they have to remain those for Carrie to write, for Carrie to be able to have this column. And the other thing is, I'm not even sure those people exist. I wonder if it's Carrie's imagination, that she has this vivid imagination.
That's interesting.
And that I don't even know that those women exist because they're so beautifully archetypal. And because she's given them depth as the seasons progress, that she might just be a good writer.
Because when people watch Sex and the City, they feel like they know you, or they want to get to know you, and they want to, you know, they want to know you above and beyond the character. But I think they'd probably make a lot of false assumptions about you if they were assuming that your character was like you. Being in such a high visibility role and being such a strong character on that, do people nowadays project things onto you which are just really untrue of who you are, and does that ever cause really awkward moments?
I think people say very intimate things to me without provocation, and some of it was, you know, very funny, and it would be good anecdotes for, you know, Letterman or something. But after a while, I felt that I had deceived. It made me uncomfortable because I felt like I wasn't really deserving of it, and it wasn't my place to know it, because there wasn't a lot I could do with the information except thank them. You know, but what I've now, I think, is that I had an interesting thing happen. I went to see a play, and I walked into this man's dressing room, and who I don't know well, and he said to me, "Oh, I didn't recognize you with your clothes on." And this is like a real theater act. This is like a, you know, big time actor. And I thought, it's a thing that I struggle with the show, for those people who haven't seen it, that they assume that it's four women running around New York City searching for the ultimate orgasm. And it's not about that. And I struggle very hard to convince people that without forcing them to watch the show, which I'm not, you know, disinclined to do, I'd be happy to do that too, but that I don't run around naked on the show. I've never been naked on the show. You should recognize me with clothes on, because I'm, first of all, not Carrie, and second of all, she wears clothing. Less so than more, you know, sometimes it's just a tea bag, but you could call it an outfit.
Well, speaking of clothing, she wears, like, incredible clothes. I mean, she has incredible outfits, and how do you dress compared to how she dresses?
I just wear more. I'm far less daring, far less daring. And really, I don't think my husband would be comfortable if I dressed like that, and I sort of honor his more...
You mean in a very provocative way.
Yes, provocative, or, you know, yes. A lot of diaphanous things and...
A lot of navels.
Smaller, yes, exactly. And I sort of honor that about Matthew, because it's one of the qualities I like about him, and... she's just a much more daring person and a much more eccentric dresser than I'll ever be.
Now, you've been acting virtually all your life. You were on Broadway when you were 10. Did you want to start acting, or did your mother nudge you into that?
Actually, my brother Toby was the first person in our house that was an actor, and I think what happened was, there was a supplement in our local paper in the Cincinnati Enquirer. It's called the Mini Page. It was for children. They had a little ad for an audition for the Little Match Girl. And we were taking creative dramatics classes, but everybody in the neighborhood did. You know, it's something you did on Saturday mornings at the University of Cincinnati. They had this program for kids. And I was also a dancer at the time. I was dancing with the Cincinnati Ballet Company as a student. And I just saw it, and I showed it to my mother, and I don't know what made me think that I even had a reason to go and stand in line on audition, but I just said, can we go? And she said yes, and she took me, and I auditioned, and I got the part of the Little Match Girl. And at the time, what I loved about it was they paid me $500 cash, and they gave me $5 after shooting every day. They would drop me off in time to get to my ballet lessons with $5. And this was 1973. And at the time, an ice cream cone at Baskin-Robbins was a quarter. And two hamburgers, french fries, and a Coke at McDonald's, which I wasn't allowed to have any of these things if my parents knew about it, was less than a dollar. So I had basically about $4 left every day. And I thought, you know, coming from no money, I thought, well, this is it. This is the life, you know?
You're not supposed to eat McDonald's on the way to the ballet lesson.
Of course not. Of course not. But I was fast. I could eat when I was a dance. I would eat so fast, I would take a bag of M&Ms and just open my gullet and just pour it in because you had to get it in you before my mom caught me.
What was the problem with it? What was the problem, that it wasn't healthy or that it was too expensive?
It was both a combination of not good for you and too expensive. And also, my mother always knew which company was building bombs for the war, or, you know, which company had shut down a nursing home in order to put up a burger chef, or Hostess was involved with AT&T, and they were involved in the war in Vietnam, or the lettuce we couldn't have because of Cesar Chavez, and they only used iceberg lettuce at McDonald's. I mean, there was a heap of things that, I'm surprised we didn't starve to death with all the rules. And all the other kids in the neighborhood be going to, you know, whatever the local burger, you know, king chef. I don't want to indict anybody. But we weren't allowed. We had to have homemade hamburgers, and who wants those?
Your family was also on and off welfare for a while.
Mm-hmm.
What was the problem that caused the lack of income?
I think just simply not being able to make enough money. My stepfather was a truck driver. My real father was a writer at the time, and they just simply couldn't make ends meet. And my mother was not working at the time. She stopped. She was a school teacher, and she stopped when I was about 2 years old. And they simply couldn't make enough money to do everything that was required. You know, there were many times that we didn't have Christmas, or our phones were turned off. But the thing I want to say about that is that I didn't really know the degree to which it was different than anybody else in our neighborhood. I knew we were a little different when we didn't have Christmas presents. But I know that this is not an uncommon story. And I think the reason I didn't realize how different it was, especially because I grew up in an affluent neighborhood, was my parents were very smart about scholarships and free programs, especially in the arts. We could go to the theater and the ballet and the symphony for free. As long as we maintained a B average, we could take ballet lessons for free. It was a sort of contradictory life compared to what our financial means were. But they were smart, and we listened to NPR, so we were educated.
How did you end up in a wealthy neighborhood if you didn't have money?
Because there was one house on the block, we always found it, where a crazy man lived. And it was in disarray and in terrible neglect. And I think it was some tiny, tiny amount of money to buy. And so my stepfather's mother gave them the down payment, and they bought it for nothing. And it was on a beautiful street, and it was just a wreck of a house, and we somehow managed to make it more of a wreck of a house. So that's just another example of my parents' sort of industrious nature, you know?
We're listening to an interview recorded last summer with Sarah Jessica Parker. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview we recorded last summer with Sarah Jessica Parker at the Old Wailing Church in Martha's Vineyard.
You know, we were talking about Sex and the City. You basically went through puberty on stage. I mean, age 10, you were in a Harold Pinter play. Age 13, I think it was, you started Annie for 2 years on Broadway. Did you replace Andrea McArdle?
I came in when Andrea was an orphan. I mean, when she was Annie, I came in as an orphan.
Oh.
And then I matriculated to the role of Annie. After her replacement left the show, I was the third Annie.
So, you know, if you're doing Annie ages 13 to 15, you're pretty much kind of developing on stage and going through those sometimes really embarrassing changes or at least puzzling changes on stage in front of people, plus you're doing it playing a child.
Yeah.
So what was that like? Did it make it more difficult to go through those changes?
I matured late. So those changes were more radical when I was doing Square Pegs, which were more appropriate to that show. However, there was a conversation about 2 months after I took over the role of Annie. The stage manager took me aside and he said to me, naturally, the year I took over the role of Annie, I grew 6 inches in a year, naturally. So he said to me, they were putting out a road company, and this little tiny thing came backstage. She was going to play Annie on the road, and she was easily a foot and a half shorter than I was. And he said, see that little girl? And I said, yes. And he said, you're getting too big. Put that on the back burner, he said. But just put it on your back burner, he said to me. And I thought, well, what are we going to do about this? I mean, what can I... And I knew that he was suggesting that there was going to come a point that if I sat on Daddy Warbucks' lap, that it would look... Daddy's Warbucks agenda, it would switch. It would no longer be about his charitable nature, his like mercy, you know, his like desire to be a parent. And I was very, very worried. And then I told somebody and they said, well, you know, there's, you know, simply nothing you can do. And I did exactly that. I thought, well, you know, I don't want to be short. I really wanted to be taller. And then I wanted to go to high school and I wanted my brown hair back. Oops. I thought, well, you know, he's kind of right to have told me. It was like this harsh life lesson. And for a second, I was like, I'm just like Judy Garland with the pills and Louis B. Mayer. And this will be chapter 14 of my book, you know.
Well, it must have been very difficult to make the transition from, you know, like child star to woman and to, you know, adult actress. I guess it was lucky you had a transition in a way through Square Pegs, which is a TV series, a very good one, about high school and mm-hmm. about a couple of misfits in high school, so that even if you were feeling a little misfittish yourself,
yes.
that would have been perfect.
It
to
was
be
exactly.
Character.
And I thought a lot about that because my mother used to talk about this transition from child performer to adult actor, and that there was a really big difference and expectations were different, and that she thought what I should do is only work in the theater during that period where the way you are scrutinized was so much less, although I'm not talking about the New York theater critics, but the amount of numbers of people that you're exposed to, that you should just, she always said to me, just make smart choices now. Try to do good plays in New York where you just work on being an actor. And then Square Pegs came along, and she was very reluctant to let me work in television, very nervous about it. But she felt, my parents felt like it was a show about real girls and real feelings and what it's like to be, in fact, what I felt at the time, which was a misfit. I had been away from students for a long time. The minute I left Annie, I dyed my hair back to brown, and I went right to public high school, and I tried to fit in, and in fact, I really didn't. I mean, I had a couple of good friends, but it felt very right. It was a fortuitous moment, a short-lived moment, but just the sort of right amount of time to get through, in fact, what easily could have been a rough period if I wanted to pursue it as an actor.
You mentioned that you're concerned about what happens, you know, in a few years, because for actresses, it's much more difficult than for actors in terms mm-hmm. of getting roles. What are specifically some of your concerns?
That I will be, you know, relegated to roles that aren't, you know, really fleshed out and interesting, that I will be... I just don't want to be sad about choices. I don't want to feel disappointed about the quality of opportunities. And so I try to be very realistic about what the future holds. I mean, I look at really wonderful actresses, some of the greatest actresses in my time, who struggle, who I've spoken to, who put their hands on their head and say, who would have thought that I would feel this way? Who would have thought that some young actress would be standing clutching a statuette saying, and you, I can't believe you're in the same category as me. You know, and the person's like, oh, I can't either. You know, that's the truth. And men seem to be more beloved and more revered, and the lines are more interesting and sexier, and it's simply not the case with women. And the parts for women get younger and younger and younger, and it's not a judgment thing, it's just a keen observation, or even not that keen. And so you just try to be realistic, and you try to remember that that's why the theater, not to use it as a salvation, but that's one of the beauties, is that, you know, Blythe Danner can come work in the theater in New York and do wonderful parts all the time, and Maria Tucci and Marion Seldes and a whole class of wonderful actresses, and Meryl Streep. Because there are great roles in the theater for women, and they simply aren't completely always there in film, and more so in television, though they are.
One last question. Did you already know how to walk in really high heels for Sex and the City, or is that something you had to learn for the part?
Well, I do love high heels. I love them. And I thought I walked in them pretty well, but looking back now, I realize that I have achieved a skill, a level of not only walking, but running in high heels. I could run a marathon, and I love the way it makes me feel, and I love that my character gets to wear those great shoes.
Thank you so
much. Oh, my God, this is a joy. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Sarah Jessica Parker recorded last summer at the Old Wailing Church on Martha's Vineyard at a benefit for public radio station WBUR. Our thanks to our colleagues at WBUR who produced and recorded the event. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.